So here we are, Mr. Parry, episode 9 of On the Record, the podcast which is gripping the nation.
It is.
With all of our stories from the United States of America.
Yes.
We haven't reached the end of those stories yet.
We certainly haven't.
And in fact, the more we talk about it, the more we kind of remember.
I totally agree.
Because I've forgotten quite a lot about the years that we spent in America because it was so long ago.
Et moi.
Indeed.
That now, means and me.
One of the things we haven't talked about really is the number of parties that we got invited to.
Because, there were parties?
There were a lot of parties.
Hey, not only were a lot of parties, life was a party.
It really was.
Working in Manhattan in the 80s and 90s,
it really was. I was once invited to a party in Greenwich Village, right? By a guy that you'll remember called John Carney.
Carney.
Who was a lawyer.
Lawyer.
Who happened to rather like a drink as well.
He certainly did,
he was a guy who was famously an antitrust lawyer down in Wall Street, right?
Yes.
And he won his first big case.
Yes.
And his wife said to him that she wanted him to buy a flat in Manhattan.
Yeah.
To which he said, I want to buy a Jaguar. Because that was how much, and it was a choice between buying a Jaguar and an apartment in Manhattan.
Right.
She ended up winning the battle. He bought the apartment in Greenwich Village, in Washington Square Park, in fact, which became worth something like $2 million.
Yes, obviously.
Which he then sold. But it wasn't in his house, it was in his mate's house. And we were staggering around, and it was a beautiful, big apartment, right? But it turned out to be the apartment belonging to a guy called Milt Maclin, who I don't know whether you remember.
Milt Maclin.
Milt Maclin, who was the guy that wrote The French Connection.
Oh, really?
And he was a fascinating bloke.
Wow.
And he was...
What, on the book on which the film was based?
Yeah.
With Popeye and all that?
Yeah, Gene Hackman.
Yeah.
Popeye.
Yeah, he was called Popeye in the film.
Was he?
Yeah, he was, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I don't remember that. But anyway, he was the guy that wrote The French Connection.
Wow.
And he was a real kind of fantastic New York character. And the apartment had things like sort of lions' heads on the
wall.
On the walls
that
and stuff like that.
That he shot in Africa.
Yeah, something like that.
Nah, it wasn't a big game on, too, was he?
Well, I don't know what he
was. Goes down in my estimation if he was.
Well, he might not have shot them himself.
You know, there's only one rhinoceros left in the world, the white-nosed rhinoceros.
Yeah, but we're not talking about
that. Yeah, anyway, go on, yeah.
This is On the Record.
Yes, yeah, sure.
This is not the other podcast.
Sure.
Anyway, it was one of those great parties where. In the sort of early part of the 80s, there was an awful lot of nefarious activity going on, as you can imagine. People thought nothing of putting out a big bowl of cocaine,
for example, which people could have a snort of if they wanted to.
And it was not the kind of stuff that you hear about nowadays, which is cut horribly. It was all very, very pure.
Yeah.
And everyone
thought nothing of it.
Well, everybody thought nothing of doing it because, you know, I'm not going to tell you what I got up to.
That's right.
But everybody, it was very normal behaviour. There was lawyers there was Wall Street brokers there, there was journalists. There was people who worked in television.
Sure.
Everybody was doing the same thing.
That's right.
It was quite remarkable.
Well, do you remember, we were having a party at your place one night, and somebody at the party...
Was this in my place in 30th Street?
It was in your brownstone.
Yeah, the 30th Street.
Yeah. You have to go about five flights of stairs.
Oh, no, that was 36th Street.
36th Street, So so I remember somebody said, hey, run out of weed, man. And not that you and I had anything to do with that,
of course not,
somebody at the party said, run out of weed. So somebody said, oh, no, my dealer will be around in like 30 minutes. Don't you worry, be here. So the guy comes round, delivers the weed to whoever wanted it. But then, do you remember this guy? You'll know who he was. He was a kind of would-be musician. And he'd actually brought a tape of his own version of Whiter Shade of Pale.
Yeah, I remember this guy. His name was Larry.
Larry, okay. So anyway, we're all having a great party. We're all English journalists talking amongst ourselves. He suddenly goes and puts his Whiter Shade and then sort of goes into this catatonic sort of trance, lies back on the couch and says, oh, listen to this. And his own version was actually quite similar to the original version.
Yeah.
And he said he spent 3 months doing it, electronic machines and all that.
Yeah.
And all we wanted to do was push off because we didn't want this blasting out at, you know, huge decibels.
Yes.
And in the end, we had to... sort of force him out the door.
Yes.
And we had to throw his tape out the window to him in the street because he wouldn't go away.
He wouldn't go away, very unfortunate. But, I mean, you must have been invited to some interesting parties in your role, basically, as the Daily Express man there. Well, I remember getting invited to a Russian party once, which was on the Upper East Side, where all they served was caviar and those little blinis, you know, those little tiny Russian pancakes.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they had all this weird vodka.
Yes.
So, for example...
Banana-flavoured vodka.
Yeah, and in those days you couldn't buy... You know, lots of different flavoured vodka as a general principle.
That's right.
And this stuff seemed to be like homemade vodka.
Yes.
And the one that I remember thinking was the most bizarre was horseradish flavour.
Mm.
Horseradish flavoured vodka.
God.
And I was chatted up by this woman.
You can't even eat horseradish on a plate.
Really?
No, you don't
like it with roast beef?
No, I don't. No.
All right.
No.
And I was chatted up by this woman, this Russian woman, very beautiful Russian woman.
Yes, yes.
But they were Russians who had sort of somehow split from the Soviets.
Yes.
Because this was before Gorbachev and
Glasnost
and all that.
Sure.
And they were very westernised Russians.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
And so I think think they were, I don't know what they were plotting something.
Yeah,
and I couldn't quite work it out.
Taking the back Russia. Yeah.
Well, I couldn't quite work it out, yes. But they were very wealthy people, and they were kind of sizing me up for something. I couldn't quite work out what it was. I didn't know what it was they wanted me to do.
Yeah, but it didn't matter.
No.
We had a party one night in Costello's, didn't we? And Harry was sitting...
Well,
we
used to have a lot of parties in Costello's.
A lot of parties in Costello's. And Harry from The Telegraph, who we were talking about the other day, was sitting on the end of the bar.
Harry Miller.
And Harry had completely lost touch with England, but he read The Sun every day.
Uh-huh.
And his favourite page three girl in The Sun was Linda Lusardi.
Yes.
Now, we told him Linda Lusardi was coming in. She was over there on a modelling assignment, and she'd rung up somebody from one of the papers, you know, and said, well, do you guys hang out?
Yeah.
And Harry, who was about, like, 62 then, I think.
Even then.
Linda Lusardi was about 28 or something. You know, I mean, now, he'd been sitting in Costello's all day on the same stool right at the end of the bar drinking whiskey.
And he used to be, like, one of those drunks who actually did sound and look very drunk,
but he could
maintain it for a long time.
Yes, he had the the maudlin eyes of a dog that you know, what do you call them dogs, like spaniel eyes or something like that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
the bloodhound eyes. That's right. And when I said, Linda Lusardi, I can't believe it. No, I haven't even had a shave today, you know, because he hadn't even been sitting there since last night, I think. So, remarkably, he picks up this tumbler of whiskey that he's got and he grabs two paper napkins, right? And then he pours his whiskey into his napkin and then he rubs it all over his face.
Right.
Because he thought that would do something for him. I don't really thought it looked more attractive to Linda Lusardi.
Make him smell like a drunk.
Well, yeah, but he wasn't thinking straight. You know, he'd been drinking, I don't know, best part of 24 hours, I think.
Mm.
And what happened was all the wet paper, caught on his one-day growth.
Yeah.
And he looked like Father Christmas. He looked ridiculous and ludicrous.
Mm.
And Linda Lusardi came in and she laughed so much she nearly fell over and he fell off his seat.
Right.
Because he was so hurt by the mockery she was giving him.
How bizarre.
Anyway, parties like that used to happen all the time, you can't really say.
Well, lots of unusual things used to happen in Costello's. I remember one night when there was a bunch of us in there and it would sort of split into two, wouldn't it? There'd be in most American bars, you've got the two sort of steel bars where the serving part is.
Yeah, that's right.
Where old Herbie, the terrible waiter,
don't stand there.
Yeah, where Herbie, the terrible waiter, who had famously spilt Windsor soup on the king.
That's right.
On some boat or other when he was coming over from Germany.
That's right.
They would be on the right-hand side, all the Americans, some of whom were journos, some of whom were other things.
Telephone operators. Well, telephone people. Yeah.
Telephone people. And then on our side, the left-hand side,
that's
were all the sort of Brits.
That's right.
And I remember it got quite late one night, and there was two or three people, and there was a bit of a sort of a row going on at the far end that we couldn't really see. And suddenly there was a massive noise, which none of us really recognised. We looked over, and the guy... who was having a row with a girl?
Yes,
was holding a gun in his hand.
My God!
And had just fired
a
bullet.
It's in Costello.
Yeah,
he fired a bullet into the ceiling.
And just fired a bullet into the ceiling.
My God!
It turned out he was an off-duty cop.
Right.
And he was having a row with his girlfriend.
Oh, this wasn't the guys who worked downtown, was it? With Peter?
No,
because one of his girls was married to a cop.
Well, no, it wasn't. No, I don't think we ever really knew who the guy was.
Really?
But he was in Costello's because it was quite a well-known bar to go and drink in.
Well, of course it was,
And he was asked politely, please put the gun down and put it back in his pocket or away into the holster.
Absolutely.
Which he then did and apologised profusely, said, oh, I'm really sorry, guys.
I'm really sorry.
He sort of waved and bought us all a drink, said, oh, I'm sorry, man.
I mean,
you get to the point where you think, well, at what point is that not a rather unusual thing that's just happened?
I totally agree. The best organised parties were always the diplomatic ones, okay?
Yeah.
So on New Year's Day, we got invited to the British Information Services, which is in fact the consulate in New York
for
the embassy in Washington.
Right.
And there's a great guy who ran it called Mike somebody. Do you remember?
I remember the guy that used to run it.
Yeah, Mike, and he had glasses and all that. And he said, chaps, I know you've had a very big New Year's.
He was up on sort of the 50s somewhere on Third Avenue,
wasn't
he?
Yeah, 57th
or 3rd or something.
And the New Year's, some of the New Year's Eve parties were great. We'll get to in a minute, you know. But he said, chaps, you must come join me. A traditional English thing is always get together on New Year's Day, have a few drinks, you know, and come and, enjoy my hospitality. And it was lavish because it was all paid for by the British government.
Yeah.
So anyway, you remember...
Effectively by the British taxpayer.
The British taxpayer, that's right, yeah. Now, the guy who ran the express office, Myers. Stan Myers?
No, it wasn't Stan Myers.
Who was that? Stan Mays.
Stan Mays,
there you go.
Yeah.
So he was like an inveritable drunk, and he was the only guy in New York, the only person in New York who didn't know that Stan Mays was a stand-up, fall-down drunk, was his wife.
Yes.
And they lived in a little apartment in Tudor City.
Yes.
They had a place out in the country, didn't they?
I think they did.
Yeah, but
Long Island or somewhere.
But during the week, they lived in this tiny little apartment, apparently, almost like a bedsit.
And he seemed to be ancient to me anyway, because I was in my 20s when I first met all these people.
Yeah, that's right.
Some of them seemed to me to be absolutely ancient.
Yeah, they were, yeah. So sometimes, and I was working late in the office, if I was there at 7 o'clock, you know, and Stan had disappeared since like 1, 2 o'clock at lunchtime, as he did, when drinking whiskey with Ralph Champion from The Mirror, you know. Yes. The phone would go, and it would be Stan's wife. Mm. It was an extremely well-spoken English woman, you know. She said, oh, hello, is Stanley there,
And she
please?
Called him Stanley.
That's right. Yes. Is Stanley there, please? And I said, no, I'm sorry. Is that... I can't remember her name.
Was I don't know.
Patricia? I think it was Patricia, actually, yeah. I said, no, I said, Patricia. Yes, it is. Who's that? I said, oh, it's Mike Parry. Oh, Michael, how are you getting on? Mm. I said, oh, you know, she treated me as the junior member of the office, you know, because I was about 40 years younger than Stanley.
Right.
And I said, oh, I'm absolutely fine, Patricia, and, you know, nice to hear from you again. How are you doing? Yeah, do you get out and about much? Yeah, OK, yeah. She said, well, have you any idea where Stanley might be?
Mm.
And I said, well, yeah. I said, he's probably in the pub.
Right.
And then
that's very helpful of you.
Well, I didn't know what the relationship was. You know, the first time I'd spoken to her.
Yeah.
So as this pause, and she says, the pub? She said, what would Stanley be doing in a pub? So Stanley, for the last 30 years, had been going and getting bladderated in Costello's or another bar after work for 4 or 5 hours.
I used to see him in there quite a lot.
Yeah,
and the other guy
that
he was with was that guy, Geoffrey Blythe.
Yeah, Geoffrey Blythe. Yeah,
he
I remember
to write the column for the Press Gazette.
Yeah, that's right. He did, And then Stan had somehow managed to go and get completely, you know, off his head all afternoon, go home to this tiny place in Tudor,
Tudor City.
There's not much room between them because there's a bed sit.
Yeah.
But his wife never apparently suspected, despite the fact that, you know, he's breathing beer fumes and his eyes were crossed and he was stumbling over furniture. Never suspected he would, because he told her he didn't drink. Yeah.
What was the upshot of this then? Did she go and try and find him?
No, she just said, oh, well, he'd turn up, he always does. But then didn't, you know, she wouldn't go looking in a pub. But the funniest thing about Stan was at one of these New Year's Day things, right, until you came, Bob, what's his name, who was the was he the Sky correspondent, Bob?
Oh, Bob Friend.
Bob Friend, yeah. And then, so what happens is, we're all standing around there, and Stan had been to somebody else's New Year's Day lunch.
Yeah.
And then he turned up at the embassy party, you know, the consulate party, and he walked in, and he marched up to Bob Friend and said, I've been wanting to do this for years, and booted him in the bollocks.
Right.
I mean, complete. You know, Bob Friend didn't know what was coming, and Bob was standing there with a glass in his hand.
Right. And he's a very tall guy, Bob.
Very tall
well.
Guy, Bob, and smiling at Stan, thinking, well, Stan's just off his rocker again, you know. And then Stan, honestly, booted him in the bollocks so hard, it was painful, you know. And Bob went, oh, you know.
Right.
Clearly very painful, all that. And Stan Mays, and people grabbed Stan and said, what are you doing, Stan? Are you mad? Said, no, that bastard ruined my life. And so,
and
you know.
What was the problem with him?
Well, the problem was that Stan was so intoxicated, he got the wrong guy. He was, the person he thought he was some bloke from one of the companies that take the office bag out to the airport at night. You know what I mean?
Well, why would you have thought he'd be at the party?
I've no idea, because he must have thought, you know, but he completely misrecognised him and he thought it was the bloke who dealt with the bag.
Right.
Because Stan's problem was that he would go to the pub at 2 o'clock.
Mm.
The bag man used to come at 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
Stan was never back from the pub.
Right.
The bag was always delayed. Sometimes it missed that night's
and
flight.
And this was the bag that was always sent every night with important things in it, like photographs, prints.
Yeah,
you know,
we called it the diplomatic bag.
Newspapers,
you know,
magazines.
In those days, you know, a new copy of a book that wasn't available in England, put it in the bag.
Right.
It was quite a set of photographs of Martina Navratilova. Over, never seen before, put them in the bag, you know, documents, all sorts of things.
Yeah.
And Stan was always late and he caused immense trouble.
Yeah.
So this bloke was always on his back. Mm. And Stan booted old Paul Bob, who died recently, didn't he?
Bob Friend died a few years ago. He was one of the few people who defected from the BBC.
Yes.
Because after he'd been in New York for a while, they wanted, I think, to bring him back to London, but they didn't want to give him much of a job.
No.
And he said, well, I don't really want to come back and do that.
Yeah.
That's not what I want to do. Correspondent, I've been a New York correspondent, I want to do this. And they said, no, we can't do that.
Yeah.
So he defected to Sky.
That's right.
And in fact, he appeared, I think, in one of those films like...
Anchorman.
No, it wasn't Anchorman.
It was something like that, wasn't it?
No, he was actually the newsreader, I think, for the Day After Tomorrow, one of those
disasters.
Like,
something like that,
movies.
It was, you're right, yeah.
But he had a great story, actually. This is one of my favourite stories of being on a plane.
Right.
We were talking about that last week.
Yeah, sure.
But he, when he first became, I think, got posted to Hong Kong...
Yes.
Went out from London to you know, great fanfare and all this, and he was, I think he was travelling first class.
Yeah.
And he'd had quite a few drinks apparently in the lounge, you know, right, before he got on the plane.
Who's this?
Bob Friend, yeah. And he'd got on the plane, and he was quite a childlike guy. I mean, he used to say to me, you know, he'd come out with things, and you'd say, I can't believe you're a very senior journalist, you've actually said that. But he'd said that he got very excited about being in first class, and he really wanted to get into the cockpit to see the pilot.
Right.
Because he'd never been
in
the cockpit.
In those days, you could access, couldn't you?
Well, you could, yeah. But also, he'd never been in the cockpit properly, and he really wanted to see what it was like. And so he asked the stewardess, and she said, oh, yes, well, you know, normally what happens, we'll get the plane up, and, you know, the pilot will probably come and see you, and he'll, you know, talk to you and all that. And unfortunately, as he said, you know, there was a bit of turbulence, there was this, there was that. So he just continually kept getting put off.
Yeah.
And he kept getting more drinks.
And finally, then more enthusiastic to get in the cockpit.
And more enthusiastic. Yeah. And finally, he had to go to the toilet, right? So he gets up and goes into the toilet. And his next recollection is of this terrible noise. And he couldn't work out what the noise was until he realised that suddenly... What it was the noise of somebody unscrewing the door of the toilet.
Yeah.
Because he'd gone in and fallen asleep.
Good God.
And all he could hear was this kind of...
Yeah.
And suddenly the whole door was pulled off. And he was sitting there on the toilet with his trousers around his ankles.
Disgusting.
And the stewardess said... Oh, Mr. Friend, the pilot will see you now.
Yeah.
He was so embarrassed. He said, I couldn't do anything.
Exactly. Crikey almighty. I'd have had my face for years.
Yeah.
One of the parties I went to, by the way, which... was a complete disaster. Do you remember David Bradbury, who worked for The Mirror?
Yes, very vaguely. He didn't do much.
He didn't do anything.
He worked for The Mirror.
Yeah, he didn't do
anything. He used to go into the office every day and sit there and not actually do anything.
He used to breakfast on the way to the office, right? Yeah. He was always out before 1 o'clock, for not just for drinks like you and I, but lunch.
Yes.
And then he was always out for dinner by 7,
right.
But usually in the pub from 4:30 onwards.
Yeah.
But he used to say...
He never got anything in the paper.
He never got anything in the paper. This is the whole point of the story. He used to say that, you know, I can't understand any human being who doesn't have 3 solid meals a day.
Right.
That's all he did. He was quite a large man.
He was
a large man, but he had a very nice young girlfriend for some bizarre reason.
I don't think I ever met her.
She worked at the New York Daily News, tall girl, quite prominent teeth, do you remember? Curly hair.
Not really, no.
But anyway, so he said, I can't understand anyone who doesn't have 3 solid meals a day. That's all he did. Mm. He didn't get anything in the paper for months because, A, he didn't do anything. He was a lazy get.
Right.
But, B, Paul Connew was his boss.
Yeah.
And Paul wanted every story in the paper under his name, so he didn't let him do anything. But the amazing thing is that David Bradbury had been the Paris correspondent for The Mirror when they had a Mirror correspondent, when they had a correspondent. He was useless there. You know, I met people years later. So, well, he never got into the paper there. So when they said they were pulling him out of Paris, we assumed they could bring him back to London.
Was it not the case that he didn't speak French?
He didn't speak French.
So he was stuck in a Paris office.
Yeah, yeah.
And he didn't speak French.
He didn't French, didn't file any stories. So everybody said, oh, you know, they're turfing him out of Paris now. He'll be back soon. Mm. No, send him to New York, the plum job.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable. He must have been a friend of the editor. I mean...
He must have been.
But anyway...
Of course, in those days, there wasn't the kind of scrutiny that we then, even 10 years later, we found in... You know, when you were running Express News Desk.
Yeah.
You know, we always nickel and diming the budgets.
Yeah.
But in those days, they must never have done that.
No, that's right. So anyway, the only thing he ever did, really, was just moan incessantly in the pub about, you know, life's terrible in the paper. But I said, well, David, you don't ever do any work. Right. He said, doesn't matter, you know, people work.
And these people are living in apartments paid for by the office.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, getting expenses paid for by the office, having all of their salaries banked, basically, not
That's
spending
right.
any of their own money.
That's right. So anyway, David says, oh, listen, tomorrow's a party. A friend of mine's coming into town. He says, well, you're having a big thrush in Greenwich City, in Greenwich Village. Hope you're coming down. I said, oh, OK. Who's your friend, then, from The Mirror? He said, oh, yeah, no, very famous. Mm. And I said, who is he? He said, Keith Waterhouse.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the columnist and author, you know.
The author of Billy Liar.
Billy Liar, wrote Billy Liar and that kind of stuff. Now, I'd been reading Waterhouse for years, both in The Mirror and in The Mail.
Yeah.
I just couldn't get through a column.
I just couldn't understand
his wit and his wisdom and his cynicism.
He was
and
a great
that.
Guy. A very funny guy to drink with.
Well, it's funny you should say that, you see. So anyway, so we're going to this place in Greenwich Village, and David is lording it. I mean, he's literally walking around behind Keith Waterhouse, carrying his drinks. Mm. You know what I mean? He's so in awe of this bloke. You know.
Well, he was a kind of legendary Mirror character, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. Oh, very much so. Yeah. I mean, he was. Yes, absolutely
sort of
right.
Salt of the earth, northern socialist.
Yeah.
Type.
So anyway, I'm in a corner with a few of our people. You know what I mean? And Bradbury comes up, taps me on the shoulder, says, "Michael." I said, "Yes." He said, "I don't believe you've met Waterhouse, have you?"
Mm.
And I said, "No, I haven't, actually. I've never had the pleasure." He said, "We'll soon change that." So I didn't really want to meet Waterhouse, to be honest. I wasn't that bothered. I'd only come to the party because it was a party and people there. So he said, come on, I'll make the big announcement for you, you know. We then walked around the house for 15 minutes because Bradbury was completely bladdered.
Yeah.
Couldn't find Waterhouse. Yeah. He'd, you know, gone off into the back garden with a young lady or something, you know what I mean? Or whatever he was doing.
Yeah.
And eventually Waterhouse returns, says, oh, there you are, Keith. Keith, I want to introduce you to a, you know, very, very promising young man. I mean, you know, so condescending rubbish, you know. A very young man with a great career in front of him. This is Michael Parry from the Daily Express. And Keith Waterhouse said, hello, lad.
Yeah.
He's very Yorkshire, you know. Yeah. And I said, oh, yeah, hello, Keith, yeah. He says, you like my stuff, then? I said, not really. To be honest, I'm not one of your biggest fans. He said, oh, right, well, you can fork off, you know, and turned, and that was it.
That was the end of that.
That was the end of that, yeah. That was a great introduction.
Charming
to the
as
party.
Ever from you. Well, couldn't you have just pretended that you quite liked his stuff?
No, because if you do that, right, he might have said, oh, well, which was my favourite column that you really stick in your head and all that. But I couldn't get past the first two paragraphs of any of his columns. Mm. So I didn't even pretend, you know.
Yeah.
And old Bradbury was crestfallen. He said, how could you have done that to me? He said, well, the first person I've ever met in my entire career, you know, who's blanched at Waterhouse.
Yeah.
You know, like I'd some, you know, like the Archbishop of Canterbury, you know what I mean?
Waterhouse famously came up to Costanza. He used to come to America sort of once a year.
That's right, yeah.
For an extended period of time.
That's right.
Where he would write a column from America.
Yes.
Which was exactly the same as a column he'd write in England.
Yes, that's right.
Except he just had different characters.
Yes,
in it,
that's
you know?
Right, yeah.
And he remember he arrived in Costello's one afternoon. Hmm. Having obviously spent quite a long time on the Lash down in the village.
Yes.
Because he always insisted on staying down there.
That's right,
he liked it down there because it was all very arty.
That's right,
And he'd come up past the sort of the meat market, which is now famously, you know, the old meat packing
that's
district,
right,
which has been turned into the Gansevoort, and it's very trendy now.
Sure.
They've got the High Line where you can go, we'll see it when we go to New York. Mm. But in those days, it was basically a place where it was all a bunch of warehouses and a place for sort of ladies of the night to hang around. But they hung around all day as well.
That's right.
But many of them in certain parts of that street and parts of the street corners were she-males.
Yes.
You know, they weren't, you know, as other women were.
Yeah.
They're both chicks with dicks, basically, used to be called.
Oh, dear.
And and he had fallen in love with one of these girls.
What?
And
One of these half-girls, you mean?
Yeah, he'd driven past, because they were beautiful.
Yeah.
He'd driven past in a taxi.
Did he know?
No. No, he came to Costello's and he said, I have to go back, you know, down there, because, you know, I've fallen in love with this girl that I've seen out the window.
Yeah, golly.
And we're all going, no, you don't want to do that, Keith. You really, really don't want to do
no,
that.
No, you don't, no.
Yeah. And he said, no, 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 I don't believe you. And we started telling him the story. He said, look, if you go down 9th Avenue and sort of 38th Street, they're all she-males.
Yeah.
They are not, you know, proper women.
Exactly. But you could tell from 100 yards if you weren't bladderated.
No, you couldn't.
Well, I could.
No, no, you actually couldn't.
All right.
I promise you.
All right.
I was once taken into a bar in New York by a friend of mine who worked in the city.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was like a broker, a foreign exchange broker or something like that. And he took me, it was my first week or two when I was in New York.
Right.
He took me into this bar.
Yeah.
And the joke was kind of on him because I didn't get it.
Mm.
But it turned out that everyone in the bar was a bloke. But they were beautiful-looking women.
Golly.
And that's the bit I couldn't quite get my head around.
Yeah.
And I never found out whether Waterhouse ended up finding out, as it were. But he left Costello's about 3 hours later, swearing blind he was going to go and find this woman.
Probably better not to know.
Probably better not to.
The great parties also that were thrown was when the editors arrived in town. Okay?
Yeah.
And it happened with me several times. Sir Nick came and, you know, he was pretty good. But Larry Lamb...
David English used to come as well.
David English used to come, yeah. Yeah, I had to sit down with him once as well.
Mm.
Larry Lamb came, right? Now, Larry Lamb was a great editor who made his reputation really getting Mrs. Thatcher into power when he was editor of The Sun, for which he got a knighthood. And then he became like a Fleet Street celebrity. But he was a very heavy drinker, Larry. Mm. He was a big man, a Yorkshire man. He loved Geoffrey Boycott.
Yeah.
Mr. Barry, I can tell you Geoffrey Boycott is the best number six batsman in the world. Bar none, do you understand?
Mm.
So so we'd get this note. It'd be an unbelievable note from his secretary in London. Sir Larry is visiting New York. Sir Larry will require a suite in the Carlisle Hotel, you know. Sir Larry... would you tell the Carlisle Hotel on arrival he would like a bottle of, you know, Bollinger in his room at precisely 27 degrees?
Yeah.
It was ludicrous.
Yeah.
I mean, it was talk about illusions of grandeur, you know. Anyway, he comes over. We never talked any business. He'd just go on a 5-day drinking spree because that's what Laurie liked doing.
But that's what they wanted to do, wasn't it? Because they wanted to lord it over everybody.
Yeah. So anyway, he takes us down to that restaurant, South Sea, at the South Street Seaport. Uh-huh. Do you know the one I'm talking about?
No.
Yeah, it's a big one above. It was above this sort of warehouse type thing. Okay. But anyway, so we get in there and he said. Mr. Barry. This is after he had a breakfast session with Phil Finn. And the breakfast session with Phil involved Phil going to his hotel and Larry giving him a large glass of scotch. This was about sort of 10:30 in the morning. And Phil made the mistake of saying, I'm sorry, Larry, but I don't drink scotch.
Yeah.
You do now, Mr. Finn. I do not like drinking alone, but I'm in New York City. So Phil had to have it, right? So anyway, you move on to the restaurant and he said... Right, everybody, let's sit down and have some lunch now. I will have a look at the menu. I will tell you all what we're going to eat. And, Mr. Parry, because I'm sitting next to him, here's the wine list. And you can choose the wine, Mr. Parry, and don't make any mistakes.
Terrifying, that must have been for you.
It was, yeah. Because this wine list, right, in this restaurant was so expensive, they didn't bother putting any prices next to the bottles, which is the only way I can normally gauge whether the wine's any good or not. You know what I mean? So anyway, I recognised a few white names for the fish because we're having some fish to start off with. And it arrived, and Larry said, let me taste this wine. Very surprising, Mr. Barry. Not a bad drop. Not a bad drop at all. Very good. And then the steaks arrived because we're all having the same thing. Larry ordered everybody's food. And then this bottle of red arrives, and he says, taste this. He tastes it. He says, yes, I see, Mr. Parry. Mr. Parry, what on earth gave you the fucking impression I wanted to wash my Volkswagen this afternoon? in front of everybody else, and, huge humiliation.
You don't remember what it was?
No idea. But the point is, that was lunch, right? Mm. Do you know what? After lunch, we sat at the table and had a 4 or 5 hour drinking session, and then Larry said...
Used to be normal practice.
Oh, yeah, Larry said, right... I can't see any point of moving on. I think we'll get the dinner menu. Waiter, bring us some dinner menus. We actually had dinner at the same table where we had lunch.
I know.
And I mean,
staggering.
Larry used to say, it's party time all the time.
Yeah.
It's party time. Because he said he was on leave from London, where he did exactly the same thing every day at the Savoy Hotel.
At the Savoy. Unbelievable. Unbelievable amounts of money being wasted.
Yeah.
Well, we're out of time again, I think, we've reached the end of this particular podcast.
Yeah.
There will be more, of course, to come.
Yes.
There'll be another one next week.
Great.
And then there'll be more. And, of course, if you want to see us live, you've got to come to New York.
Well, you've got to come to New York to see us live. VIP seats, I think there's still a few available.
There's a few more been put on, actually.
Yeah, but can I tell you that this is going to be the first time we're going to be in every living room in the world if they want us, because it's streamed worldwide.
I don't think we're going to be in every living room in the world.
Well, we're available in every living room in the world, put it that way.
Yeah.
So there's a streaming operation going on here, which we're very excited about. It's going to be great fun.
It is. We are the Two Mics. But in those days, it was basically a place where it was all a bunch of warehouses.
Yeah.
And a place for sort of ladies of the night to hang around. But they hung around all day as well.
That's right.
But many of them, in certain parts of that street, in parts of the street corners, were she-males.
Yes.
You know, they weren't, as other women were.
Yeah.
They're both chicks with dicks, basically, used to be called.
Oh, dear.
And and he had fallen in love with one of these girls.
What?
And
what, one of these half-girls, you mean?
Yeah, he'd driven past, because they were beautiful.
Yeah.
He'd driven past in a taxi.
Did he know?
No. No, he came to Costello's and he said, I have to go back, down there. Mm. Because, I've fallen in love with this girl that I've seen out the window.
Yeah, golly.
And we're all going, no, you don't want to do that, Keith. You really, really don't want to do
no,
that.
No, you don't, no. Remarkably, he picks up this tumbler of whiskey that he's got and he grabs two paper napkins, right? And then he pours his whiskey into his napkin and then he rubs it all over his face.
Right.
Because he thought that would do something for him. I don't know, he thought it looked more attractive to
make him smell like a drunk.
Well, yeah, but he wasn't thinking straight. He'd been drinking, I don't know, best part of 24 hours, I think.
Mm.
And what happened was all the wet paper, caught on his one-day growth.
Yeah.
And he looked like Father Christmas. He looked ridiculous and ludicrous.
Mm.
And Linda Lusardi came in, and she laughed so much she nearly fell over, and he fell off his seat.
Right.
Because he was so hurt by the mockery she was giving him.
How bizarre. And he was sitting there on the toilet with his trousers around his ankles.
Disgusting.
And the stewardess said, oh, Mr. Friend, the pilot will see you now.
Yeah.
He was so embarrassed. He said, I couldn't do anything.
Exactly.